I want to make very clear at the outset that it's normal that we as human beings have preferences. It's normal that preferences play out in human relationship. And because of our various social roles in the world, in the conventional world, these preferences can seem so innocent, so normal. I prefer my family to strangers. There's nothing wrong with that. It's natural. Or I can prefer the company of my dumb friends to those people in my life who just don't relate. And that particular preference can seem so justifiable. It's like, well, why not hang out with like-minded people? But really, it's important not to be confused about this. Social roles and social preferences and deeper heart preferences are two very different and mutually exclusive things. We can understand social roles as necessary and honor that while still not having any deeper heart preferences. Because in these examples of family and dumma friends, there are differences in closeness, in relative position to us. Of course, we're more familiar with some people than with others. And amongst friends, colleagues, kind of the general constellation of our human relationships, it's normal that we tend to be closer to some people than to others, to those people who share our interests and our views. Even the Buddha spoke about this as a natural human condition. But without wisdom and without compassion, we can get confused about these social preferences. And they can take root at a deeper level in our hearts and become a fixed stance. And when that happens, they can become poisonous. You can see it even in little children when they're 5 or 6 years old on the playground, with that kind of in-group, out-group dynamic that begins to play out at that age. And of course, teenagers are well renowned for using this dynamic against each other with social cliques. Someone's in and someone's out. And this causes so much pain. And if these preferences, these heart preferences, and if comparisons that come from them become solidified into an identity, this, of course, sets people against people. People of different political parties, ethnic groups, nations. Then what is essentially, at a deeper level, indivisible becomes divided. And really, at a societal level, at a global level right now, witness the kind of tribalism that's playing out all over the world. It's really profoundly disturbing. The world right now seems to be fracturing into smaller and smaller bits, and people become more and more hardened against each other. Aria spoke beautifully yesterday about the world of view from space. And from up there, there are no national boundaries. You can't tell where one country starts and another stops. But of course, we have, as humans, have made up, have kind of built these conventions that we take to be a truth. And they say, this is one country, that's another country. No, no, you can't come in here without a visa or a passport. And if people try, then the walls go up. And the walls that go up on the outside are mirrors or outer manifestations of the walls that people have inside, against each other. And this kind of thing really often just starts with a conflict of ideas. For example, a political affiliation, a religious affiliation. And when people lock onto this idea and make it an identity, this is what can fuel endless fear, hatred, cruelty. Under the influence of strong identification, there is me, a self, myself. I'm a Buddhist woman, Western. And then there's other. Man, monk, ooh, bad. I mustn't touch this person. Or, you know, anything. That's a joke, actually. But you know, this self and the other in capital letters, the other, is what allows people to turn the other into someone who is not human, allows them to justify no small amount of cruelty, of harm, of suffering, and any number of horrors. Wars over us and them, because it's not just me and the other out there, of course, then we make these collective identities. Okay, it's us against the world. This has happened countless times since people started building cities. And maybe before then even too, I don't know. Where once harmonious communities fracture, break into bits, and friends and neighbors turn on each other. And it can happen astonishingly quickly. This last summer, somebody gave me a book about the Spanish Civil War. And I only knew a little bit about it, kind of the basic framework. But to read in detail what happened to Spain in the blink of an eye, suddenly people in a village are killing each other. One half are for one side, one half for the other. They're murdering each other. And I actually couldn't finish the book. It was too painful. But what astonished me is how quickly that happened. How quickly collective insanity began and gained momentum. And we can say to ourselves, well, I would never fall into that. But this is kind of a fake place of safety, because none of us really know how we would be under those circumstances. We've been very, very fortunate, all of us, that in the last 70 years or so, the fabric of the world has held together, more or less. Sure, there have been wars, but it hasn't been, you know, global. And I love how we come here to this metta retreat as a community of yogis from all over. Germany, France, Holland, Italy, you know, India, Ireland, Belgium, Switzerland, America, Canada, Argentina, Malaysia, Macau, India. And we don't think anything of it. We take it for granted. But my parents, my father, and maybe your parents or grandparents, were on opposite sides of a war not too long ago. Our families were fighting each other. And there's no guarantee this won't happen again. So we have to practice metta if we care about this world. Because the only thing we can do anything about is right here. And all of that samsaric nastiness that plays out as warfare all the way down to spats on the playground between five-year-olds is ultimately first rooted in atta, which is the Pali word for self. And today I want to dissect this just a little bit, so it may get a little technical. I hope not much. Really, in the service of understanding the maker of these barriers, the maker of discord. So the basis of the sense of self can be described in a number of ways. And Andy Olensky, who is a Pali scholar in Massachusetts in America, wrote a wonderful commentary, basically, on an abhidharmic understanding of how the sense of self is constructed. And basically, it lines up with the way our entire mind-body continuum is composed. So first, there's the occupant, the one who inhabits the body. And of the aggregates, the five aggregates, this aligns to form. And then there is the beneficiary. And this is the quote-unquote self, the one who experiences pleasure and pain. And this is the realm of the aggregate of feeling tone, vedana. Then there's what Andy calls the artiste. It's the one, the self, who expresses him or herself. Who creates. And this aligns to the aggregate of perception and creating a framework around experience, labeling it, putting a word to it. Then there's the agent, in the sense of agency, the one who actually does things. And this aligns with the aggregate of formations. And finally, there's the essence. This is the one who consists of all that. And this aligns to the aggregate of consciousness. So all of these together create an owner, the one to whom it all belongs. This is the root of wrong view of Sakkaya Ditti. This is mine, this is me, this is myself, is what the owner says. And when you read the texts, you hear this phrase a lot. The Buddha says, you should not regard anything as me, mine, myself. And this package of the owner is the basis of all the suffering in the world. And from this constructed and concretized sense of self, from this atta, arises what in Pali is called mana, conceit, or asmimana, pride. Mana, just in the sense of conceit, is really an interesting cetasika, mental formation. It doesn't just mean what we colloquially think of in English as, you know, this proudful better-than-ness. It takes three basic forms. Superiority mana, which is that I'm better than anything in particular, or anyone. Or, the flip side, inferiority mana. Oh, I'm worse than anybody on the planet. I'm such a bad person. Which is just the kind of the flip side of that coin. Or, I'm equal to. I'm the same as. We're all the same. Denying conditions. So better than, worse than, equal to is what mana boils down to. And all of us are prone to some aspect of this or another. A lot of it depends on the society we grew up in. Those of us who are American grow up with this sense of equality. Everybody's the same. For example. And it's a habit we all have. We all have this habit of mana. And it's not a personal failing or a, you know, fatal flaw. It's actually not something to create a big drama about, because it's part and parcel of this samsaric human existence. And most of us, to some extent, to one extent or another, live experiencing everything through this filter of mana. And And the fact that both this sense of self, this atta, and mana are in fact illusion, hallucinations created from distorted perception, that doesn't make the perception any less vivid. It's like one of those optical illusions that's very, very difficult to see through. And when we get sucked into this illusion, everything is all about me, 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 me. There is this me in here and all the others out there, and I am somewhere on that continuum of better than, worse than, or equal to. I saw a funny quotation a little while ago. It made me laugh out loud. It said, when they find the center of the universe, a whole lot of people will be surprised to find that they are not it. Okay, so maybe we know we're not the center of the physical universe. And we can laugh at that. But part of the reason, honestly, that I laughed at it was that I could totally resonate with this felt experience of being in here and everything else being out there. And this is me and that's outside. So there can certainly be that sense that we live in the center of a universe of other beings. And then we rank these other beings based on whether we like them or we admire them or they've done something for or against us or we just don't see them at all. And again, to reiterate, conventional hierarchies are the way the conventional world works, and we can't avoid that. Nor should we. We're social animals, we human beings. And our societies require a skillful navigation of categories for us to function. But there can be a more unbalanced sense of me, mine, myself, this atta mana, that builds the walls we construct between ourselves, between me and others. And these are the walls that the metta has to break down. It's easy to radiate metta to beings we prefer or like. You know, the warm fuzzies. But beings we don't? Oh, sorry, you're on your own. I often encounter this feeling when I'm in the dining room and there are the flies. And it's just my first response, my kind of fallback response. I see the flies and I go, oh, you know, I don't like you. And, you know, sorry guys, no metta for you today. That, you know, that all it takes, though, is to see that default and not act on it. And these categories are built the way they are, constructed the way they are in the metta practice, because they're sequentially more and more difficult. And what makes them more and more difficult is that there's more and more ego involvement between the benefactor, the dear friend, not so much the neutral person, that's the invisible category, the enemy. So there's increasing potential for ego involvement, my friend. And you can notice this in the categories when you're dealing with different friends. Oh, that person's really my best friend. Oh, I like that person a lot, but no, they're not so close. You know, there can be this leaning into people we really are attached to. And then, of course, when we get to the enemy, it's like, oh, I just don't like that person. There's not so much ego involvement. Versus, how dare they do that to me? Yeah, it was 20 years ago, but I'm never going to forget it. There can be so much ego involvement. And we rank all these people, better than, worse than, equal to. So the metta, as we persist, kind of erodes these walls or blasts through them. Sometimes that can be the felt sense. So if we persist and the metta begins to arise, we see for the first time that there can be a very different response of the heart. And we can know for ourselves that beautiful evenness of heart that comes when the metta is strong. Because pure metta, of course, is free from any form of clinging or aversion, based on identification, based on preference, based on atta, based on mana. And the less we cling, the emptier we are, the more room there is for each other in these hearts. When I say the emptier we are of this atta and this mana. And one of the things that makes pure metta so incredibly peaceful, and some of you have mentioned this in your interview, oh, it was so peaceful, is that breaking down of these barriers that atta and mana construct. And at first in the metta practice, we can feel, especially for the dear friends, we can feel this warmth of heart and a kind of affective flow. And we think this is pure metta. And somebody came in to report the other day. She said, you know, I thought that was metta, but wow. The heart fell into this really quiet, calm, cool place. Now I see the difference. And this peacefulness is the essence of pure metta, this coolness. Saitou calls it metta aircon. And when we have that metta air conditioning, the habit of well-wishing replaces those habits of mine-making, I, me, mine, of owning, of preferring. It works by taking our fear, our attachment, our aversion, putting it to the side and replacing it. The metta replaces these as a substitution of opposites. And we can see this even in everyday life. We say in English sometimes how we lose ourselves in some service-oriented task or another. Perhaps we're helping an ill relative. And we completely drop these barriers for that time. And we become one with the task, one with the service and the offering of the heart. Even more so, though, when we consciously cultivate the loving kindness, as you're doing here. And with the conscious cultivation of loving kindness, the attenuated I, me, and mine becomes weaker and weaker and weaker. So instead of it being the default setting, metta is the default setting. And by going through the categories as we do, going from category to category, and also within each category, gradually expanding the scope of the metta, we strengthen the metta and we make it more versatile, more fluid. And when this begins to happen, and many of you are actually reporting this in your interviews, what we experience is that the quality of the metta becomes the same, regardless of what category or what being we're radiating it for. And we can no longer tell the difference between beings based on the metta we are experiencing. Of course we know the difference between our dear friend and our enemy. We don't lose sight of that. But the heart preference is gone. That movement of the mind that says, my friend, my enemy, better than, worse than, gone. And the metta flows in the same way towards our dearest friend, towards a stranger, towards an enemy, towards all beings. And after some time in the practice, when we can successfully extend this metta for our enemies, for all beings, this even-heartedness, even-mindedness, is quite a tangible indication that the barriers of preference have been broken down. And at that point, there's only one sphere of metta activity, and it encompasses all, everyone, without distinction. And there isn't any longer any difference in the well-wishing for oneself or any other being. And I love this teaching because it's so practical and pragmatic. It doesn't just exist in here in this meditation hall. We take it out into our lives. And when we experience this limitlessness of loving kindness, we no longer suffer on account of self-centeredness, of atta, of mana. And as the heart opens in this way, the world becomes a bigger and more inclusive, loving place. Regardless of others' identities, what they've done to us or for us. And as Ariya said yesterday, it's more than just us as people. Because, as you know very well from the chants we do, metta is to be radiated to all beings in all realms and in all directions. All other beings, all beings. And as humans, as human beings, We tend to have this kind of collective atta, this collective mana, that we as people are somehow different from the rest, somehow better than the rest. And mostly, we don't even question this. It's just the way we see the world. It's very interesting here in Burma. When you learn Burmese language, one of the things that's a big stumbling block is when you count things. You don't just say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You say, when you're applying these numbers to objects, different kinds of objects have different counting kind of counting words that are attached to them. So when we talk about people in Burmese, there's a counting word for monastics, ba. So I would say Ponji Thonba. One for ordinary people, which is Yao. So Yogi Thon Yao, three yogis. And one for animals, Gaon, which kind of means head. So whatever kind of animal, Kwe Thon. So these counting numbers really illustrate that tendency we have as human beings to rank each other. And when we take these rankings seriously as the truth of the way things really are, rather than just social convention, of course, it's the same kind of warfare that we can experience between all of us as human beings. When we somehow assume we're superior to all other life forms on the planet, and out of this profound ignorance of mana and kind of collective atta, we're obliterating many of the species on this earth. Literally, I mean, driving bulldozers into them and burning them and any number of ways of harming. And we assume it's okay. It's, you know, we're people. We're allowed to do this. And somehow justifiable. Just the natural order of things. And sometimes somebody might pose a question to authorities about some action or another that harms something. And there's just this big collective shrug. It's like, oh, it's just a bird. Who cares? People are more important. But there are 9 million species, roughly, more or less, on this earth. And we're only one of them. What makes us think we have the right to take the place over? It's this mana, it's this atta. And in the metta practice, when we go to all beings, we can begin to see how we put people on a pedestal above everything else. And it seems to be built into the categories, you know, because we start with people and then we go to all beings. All beings at the end, almost as an afterthought. That's what we can think anyway. But really, when you look at the Metta Sutta and the other early texts, some of which we've been chanting, that's obviously not what's meant at all. Instead, it's actually the way these categories are constructed, it's a reflection of closeness, of familiarity, and relative familiarity. so that we start with ourselves, we go to other people, and then we go to all beings. Because we can relate to other people more easily than we can relate to a fish or an earthworm. All beings is a category that's almost impossible to understand, to comprehend, to wrap our minds around. I mean, just talking about living beings on this planet, biological living beings, as I said, there are 9 million species. And as I was thinking about this, I thought, well, what's 9 million? It's just a number. So I kind of got my calculator out and I figured out if you were to speak to voice the name of one species a second without stopping, it would take about 3.5 months to do this, to get through 9 million. That's not having any sleep. 24 hours a day, one species a second. That's a lot of beings and a lot of different kinds of beings. And of course, this isn't like Noah's Ark where there are only two. The number of ants on this planet is uncountable. Not to mention lots of other small forms of life. And that's just biological beings. That's not beings we have an even harder time comprehending, like devas, celestial beings, earth spirits. The chants say devas, nagas, mahidikas, all these different categories of beings. True and deep metta, though, is all-encompassing. So fortunately, we don't have to visualize all those beings. We couldn't, anyway. The heart really can open to all of them. But as we develop the loving kindness, we do have to connect in some way. And admittedly, it's a challenge. And so if you're working with all beings and you find this category hard to connect with, there are various ways to make it easier. You don't have to dive into the deep end of the pond by just going all beings and, you know, then what? It's just two words, all beings, and there's no place to connect. You don't have to dive in the deep end. The classical way is to take all these beings and begin small. So, for example, connect with yourself and imagine the person on your right or your left, or just have the felt sense of the people right immediately around you. And perhaps if you have that sensitivity, the non-human beings also. And then gradually one can expand that to include all the beings in this room, all the beings in this building, in this compound, in Pinsar, in the Shan Hills, in Upper Myanmar, in Myanmar as a whole, in Asia, and pretty soon if you expand in this way, it can feel like you're holding the earth in your lap. And then expanding out to non-human beings, all the other realms of existence. That's the classical way. But there are various ways you can play with this that are quite effective. One thing I've done, I started doing it out of curiosity and kind of for fun. I thought, well, okay, take all people and expand out in the traditional way. So this room, this village, Myanmar, the whole world, all the people in the world, take that as the first category, just as we take oneself as the first category, all people. And then you can go to another kind of being, a non-human being, that you respect. Just like you go to a respected person, go to a respected kind of being. So, for example, all the devas, all the celestial beings. And then radiate loving kindness for that category. And when the metta is established, then you can go to a very dear being, all border collies, for example, or whatever you happen to connect with. And then to a neutral being, kind of being, all cod. Something, it's just like, I don't relate to that. And then to something you don't like, all flies or all cockroaches. Or for Mimi, it would be all rats. The enemy. And once the metta is established for that enemy category of beings, then to just let the metta flow out to all, encompassing all. It's just kind of a crutch, a form that can allow you to expand the range of the loving kindness gradually in a way that you can connect. Using that same gradual immersion that we use with the basic categories of people. And with that same empathetic bridge that is the essence of this practice, just as I want to be happy and free of suffering, so may you be happy and free of suffering. And just as we as people want to be free of suffering, so may all those flies be happy and free of suffering. And just as when we use these categories for people to break down the barriers, the same thing applies. If we use that form in the same way, but in a bigger context. And when we do loving kindness for all beings, because we cannot imagine them all, because of the impossibility of that, our brains can't comprehend it. It's okay to use one or two kinds of beings, kind of as a proxy for all the rest. So don't worry if you don't connect with everything. That's why this little form works. And when we can do this, when we can radiate loving kindness to all beings like this, and the metta is in the foreground, we see the world through a much more inclusive lens. Through a lens that doesn't put me or mine of any kind in a central or more important place. Instead, we see through a lens that connects equally. Me, other people, we as humans, other beings. Those barriers of preference, of atta and mana, are broken down. And this is really an opening. It's a great compassion. Compassion that is not grief, but empathetic connection. I was thinking today in the dining room with the flies. None of us like flies. But I was remembering a story that Joanna Macy, who's an American Zen teacher, told of being in India with a Rinpoche, with Chogo Rinpoche, and she was having tea with him. And she noticed there was a fly in her teacup, and she was trying to be this cool, okay, I'm a cool Westerner, it doesn't bother me that there's a fly in my teacup. And he was getting very concerned. Oh, there's a fly in your teacup. And he leaned over and he fished it out, and he took it outside. And she was like, oh, well, he, you know, he's so concerned about me as a Westerner that I have a fly in my teacup, how touching. And he comes in and he says, he'll be okay. And she realized he wasn't concerned about her and how she was responding to the fly. He was deeply concerned about the well-being of that single fly that was drowning in her tea. So he took it out on the porch and he described how he put it on a leaf, waited till it fanned its wings and he knew it would be able to fly away, and then he came inside saying, he'll be okay. Not it will be okay, but he'll be okay. I find this very, very, very touching. Because we very naturally, it's that thing, we're people and it's a fly, you know. But it is also one of those 9 million. And the extent to which we think keeping the well-being of a fly in one's consciousness as much as the well-being of other people, the extent to which we think this is strange is the extent to which we need to develop more pure metta. Because that sense of strangeness is atta, is mana. And so we just need to develop a wider, deeper metta heart that can include flies. Somebody once asked His Holiness the Dalai Lama how to raise a baby. I'm assuming this person was about to have one, be a parent. And His Holiness reputedly said, teach them to respect insects. And at first this might seem kind of a joke. It's like, what a throwaway line, teach them to respect insects. But there's much more depth there than meets the eye. Because if we can really offer care to insects, small creatures that we otherwise don't even pay any attention to or actively dislike, this is a great expansion of the heart's range. It's a great expansion of our ability to really connect with other beings empathetically. And when we enter into relationship with the others, those 800,999,999 others, something like that, when we enter into relationship with all of those others, we of necessity have to drop our sense of importance, of self-importance, of human importance. And when we enter into relationship with those 9 other million plus all the unseen beings, that's an even greater expansion and an even greater letting go of self-importance, letting go of atta and mana. His Holiness went on to explain, if they can learn to love something that to them is innately ugly and small, learn that an insect has the same life force as they. That's the beginning. And basically, you have to watch yourself. If you want your child to be special, you have to be special. Generous, kind, loving, forgiving. And the same goes with us as just people, even if we don't have kids. We can model this for other people. So atta, mana, the bubble they create limits the heart's scope. the barriers they create separate us from each other. His Holiness again. He puts it this way. If we think only of ourselves, forget about other beings, then our minds occupy a very small area. Inside that small area, even tiny problems appear very big. So if you think only of yourself, only your own happiness, the result is actually less happiness. You get more anxiety and more fear. But when you develop a sense of concern for others, you realize, just like ourselves, they also want happiness. They also want satisfaction. And when you have this sense of concern, your mind automatically widens. And at this point, your own problems, even big problems, will not be so significant. The result? Big increase in peace of mind. I love that, how he links concern for others with a greater happiness and a greater peace of mind. Because this is what comes when we drop that atta and that mana. And as we cultivate metta more and more and more deeply, and for broader and broader categories, it releases us from those entanglements of the ego and eventually opens that door to a tender care that encompasses all beings in all realms and in all directions. As His Holiness says, big increase in peace of mind. So may we all have a benevolent concern for all beings, bringing peace of mind for ourselves and for the benefit of all beings in all realms and in all directions. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.